Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 21st, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a special Courthouse Steps teleforum on the case Impressions Products v. Lexmark International, which was heard in the Supreme Court today. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor David S. Olson, Associate Professor of Law at Boston College Law School. I will turn it over to Professor Olson to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Professor Olson. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. It's my pleasure to talk about this case, which we talked about a week or two ago, and the court heard argument today. It was an interesting argument, I'd say not entirely surprising, but let me give a brief background on the case, and then I'll come back to the argument and a few things that I noted from the argument. So the case, Impression Products versus Lexmark, rather, at issue is Lexmark sells printer cartridges for its printers, and those cartridges, some of them are sold with no restrictions whatsoever. Others are sold as part of a special program where they give a lower price, and they have restrictions saying you can't reuse or resell the cartridges. What First Impression does is buy these cartridges, including the ones that have the limitation, the contract limitation on their sale. Lexmark buys these from consumers who've bought the cartridges or from other resellers, and then it does refill and reuse the cartridges and sell them back to consumers. So it competes with Lexmark. First Impression competes with Lexmark, and Lexmark wanted to keep resellers out of these cartridges. What they're effectively doing is price discrimination. They're selling to some consumers who are either going to use less cartridges or have a lower price point that they're willing to pay. They're selling them the cartridge for a cheaper price, but then demanding that this kind of cartridge not be reused in a way that would undercut their sales at a higher price point to others. So that's what their practice is. The issue is whether they're allowed to do that. So is Lexmark allowed through contract law to say the limitation on your use is use only for personal use, not reuse or resale of this cartridge? If someone does reuse or resell, that's clearly a contract law violation. Everybody's in agreement on that. But what Lexmark wants to do is say that's also a patent law violation in that the license to use. So the patent law, Section 271 of the patent statute says that the patentee has the right to, the exclusive right to make, use, sell, or import as well. And so the argument is that this exclusive right to use is being violated if you make a use that's outside of that original license, that contract which gave a license only for the use and not for reuse or resale. So what Lexmark wants to do is have patent damages apply against both it could be against the individual who resold it, but of course what Lexmark is really interested in is having patent damages available, including treble damages for willful infringement against First Impression and other resellers. And that would be effective because contract law can't touch First Impression because there's no privity of contract as long as First Impression doesn't buy directly from Lexmark, whereas patent damages could be a very effective tool in keeping Lexmark off the market. So that's the kind of economics and the legal argument. This runs up against First Impression's argument of patent exhaustion. And this goes back, and the court spent some interesting time trying to trace back, where does this come from? Is it still in the law? Why is it not codified? But the first sale doctrine, the first sale is what we usually call in copyright law, patent exhaustion and patent law. Patent exhaustion has been around and mentioned in one way or another for some 150 years. Before the 1952 Act, you can go back to the predecessor to the Patent Act, Section 151 of that law. And there the court had some language saying, that right to sell is more like a right, it's the right to vend, so it's initial sale, but not a right to control resell sale. But the problem with these early cases, as the as some of the justices were pointing out, and then as the counsel for Lexmark pointed out, the problem with these early cases is when they're saying it's a right to VIN, not to control resale, is you didn't usually in these early cases, although we did have, in one case it's different, but in some of these early cases you didn't have that particular specific contract term that limited the license and was controlling the resale. So how to interpret some of that early language is somewhat difficult. So the court was really pressing counsel for first impression to say, why isn't this codified? Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy both pressed counsel on that, saying, if this is a well-established patent law, why has it not been codified? The answer was, well, you know, some areas aren't codified. The Deputy Solicitor General also agreed with first impressions, the defendant in the case, on this point, and said, you know, this is the sort of thing that's kind of always been assumed to be there. And so when the 52 Act came about and they recodified the infringement part of the statute, there was no need to specify it because this was always what was understood as kind of part of that right to sell, is that it's only a right to a first sale, and after that, the patent is exhausted. So we've got, one area that's interesting of the argument is we're going to have some pressure on where do we ground this patent exhaustion right if the court comes up with a patent exhaustion holding, because it's the provenance and exact place to attach it is somewhat unclear. The other issue in the case is whether there's extraterritorial. Let me back up and put it in a more neutral way. The other issue in the case is whether if there's a first sale in a foreign country, and then that person who buys it imports into the U.S. and sells in the U.S., can the patent owner block that importation? The patent statute explicitly gives the patent owner the right to control importation in the U.S. Patent law is explicitly territorial in that it only applies in the U.S. And so the issue there is whether there's patent exhaustion for an international sale and then the good is imported into the U.S. First impression says yes. Lexmark says no, that patent law is territorial and therefore you shouldn't extraterritorially apply patent law. Justice Alito picked up on that point, and he was pressing first impressions counsel pretty hard on the international exhaustion issue and said, in recent years the statute, we've said repeatedly, we being the court, that the statute doesn't apply outside the U.S. unless there's a clear statement. There's no clear statement here. Why should patent law have extraterritorial effect? I thought the counsel was pretty good with the comeback saying, well, that's not really extraterritorial because we're only talking about application of U.S. patent law to sales made in the U.S. And what we're saying is that if there's a first authorized sale, wherever it is, then the effect in the U.S. is that there's no more patent rights. And so then he analogized it to the Kurtzain case, the copyright case that said that if a copyrighted book is sold anywhere in the world and it's an authorized sale by the copyright holder, then first sale applies. But copyright law is, of course, different because there's a specific statutory provision for first sale in copyright law, and there's nothing like that in patent law. Justice Breyer chimed in along with the First Impression Council and agreed that it's just an application of U.S. law. Also, Breyer signaled pretty strongly, saying, Justice Breyer, that the other side, Lexmark, has the harder job here. So that would, for tea leaf reading, that would lead one to presume Justice Breyer is more persuaded of the patent exhaustion occurring here. But when it comes to this international exhaustion issue, it's a harder issue. The government goes with Lexmark on this. The Deputy Solicitor General argued that a first sale that is authorized in Germany, but without with a limitation that says no importation into the U.S., that should apply and be upheld because of that right to control importation. And that therefore the government thought that domestically patent exhaustion should apply, but not internationally. The justices pressed the Solicitor General Deputy Solicitor General Stewart on that, saying, where does this come from? Is this just a policy choice? Can you base that in the statute? The Deputy Solicitor General had some trouble basing it in the statute. So that's an interesting kind of thing to look for. There's also a question of who receives the value of, or whether the patent owner can really receive the full value of a patent if the rights are exhausted by an initial sale in, say, Germany or China or wherever it is. And, you know, the idea here is you sell your good originally, say it's into the global supply chain managed, so it's a chip for a computer. You should just charge whatever the market will bear, and you've gotten the value of your patent. That was the argument of first impressions, and Justice Sotomayor, in her questioning, seemed to strongly agree with that. On the other hand, Lexmark's counsel pushed back, saying, you know, the value of your, you have a different patent in Germany and a different patent in China, or maybe no patent there, and so a first authorized sale in those countries may reflect a different value of the IP in those countries than it has in the U.S. And there are also some issues about price discrimination. So using the restriction on importation is a way to price discriminate, to charge different prices in different countries. There's argument back and forth as to the benefit of that. There's a amicus brief by some law professors and various economists saying that this is a pro-competitive and more efficient kind of way to go. And for full disclosure purposes, I should say that I signed on to that brief. So that was my opinion. The justices, it was hard to say what their take on that was. Some justices didn't seem impressed by the price discrimination guarantee or argument, and said there's no guarantee of that in the statute. That perhaps just getting the average value of the patent when it's sold is enough. Others didn't seem to engage with it as much. There are also questions about kind of the overlap between patent exhaustion and antitrust law. Justice Breyer was interested in that, and whether you need patent exhaustion to affect or whether antitrust law on its own could kind of do the job and protect against anti-competitive uses of kind of controlling downstream resale. So that's the kind of the main things that I took away. The counsel for Lexmark was allowed to talk, I'd say, longer and without interruption. It's hard to say whether that means that counsel, whether the justices were agreeing with what counsel was saying or whether they disagree but didn't think it was worth arguing about. One can never know what to say from that. They were more active at first questioning the counsel for first impression. My sense was that some of that was because counsel for first impression, in my opinion, has a bit harder argument as to finding that statutory basis for the patent exhaustion doctrine, whereas counsel for Lexmark is simply saying there is none and it shouldn't exist. So I think that gives a bit of a summary, and I think there might be some questions. So why don't I stop there and see if there are questions, and we can explore anything else through the question and answer.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Looks like we have our first question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you guys today?
Good, thanks.
So, Mike, I'm actually really curious, what kind of questions did Justice Breyer ask, you know, since he authored the Kirtan opinion? You know,
right.
I'm really interested in what his take on this issue was.
Yeah, good question. So he certainly didn't seem to be backing away from Kirtan in any way. He explicitly said he thought Lexmark has the harder job. He did ask counsel for first impression, well, you know, I don't feel you've adequately responded to their argument that, you know, if they receive money in Germany for the German patent, how do they get the value for the U.S. patent? And that's the point where the Council for First Impression came back and said, well, you know, they can kind of get the average value, and there's no guarantee of price discrimination. And Justice Sotomayor agreed that as well. One other, just check my notes here. When Chief Justice Roberts was asking why contract law and state law are inadequate, and when the counsel for for Lexmark was coming back and saying, you know, you can't enforce limitations downstream and there could be a lot of value, Justice Breyer came back and said, why can't you enforce the contract downstream? He said, well, there's not privity. He says, well, why don't you just require the person who sells it to just resell it with the requirement that they promise not to whatever it is. So he, Justice Breyer, suggested kind of a cascading set of contracts where each contractee is required to restrict the use of the next contractee, and therefore you could get through it by patent law. And the counsel came back and said, well, you know, that's hard to do. It's kind of what happened here, but it's hard to do. Justice Breyer came back and said, well, it's hard to get away with, and one of the reasons is antitrust law, so then suggested that the solution, although it's possible, might run into antitrust problems. So that was kind of hard for me to figure out where Justice Breyer was going with that, which is, you know, he was saying, well, maybe contract law is sufficient, but then he was saying, well, if you get too restrictive in your contracts and restricting downstream resale, you might violate antitrust law. So it seemed like you're kind of in trouble either way. Not sure quite where he's going with some of the time. He did talk about, in other points, the patent monopoly and that they want to extract maximum value and so forth, but that's not always that's not necessarily the unrestricted right of the that's given by the Patent Act. So, you know, my prediction, it's hard to predict these sort of things, but I would, Justice Breyer seemed, even though there's a difference here in that the Copyright Act has a specific statutory requirement on the policy issues, Justice Breyer seemed very consistent with what his outcome in Kurtz saying, which would suggest he would say no patent. I mean, there is patent exhaustion. There's no right to restrict downstream sales or use.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement while I wait for a question. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, March 22nd. That call will feature a discussion of the oral argument in the Supreme Court case, Microsoft v. Baker, which is being heard today in the Supreme Court. That call will feature Corey Andrews, Senior Litigation Counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleform calls you may have missed, including a preview of this case with a panel of experts. While we wait for another question, I thought I'd ask, what do you think the turnaround will be on this case?
You mean how quickly we'll hear
a ruling? Yes.
Yeah, I'm. other people you have on to discuss these things might be better at this than I am. I don't have a good feel for it. There's a lot of interest. There are a lot of amicus briefs on both sides. The court seems to be. It's always hard to tell from their questions, but there definitely seem to be a variety of opinions. There seems to be some real uncertainty as to where to ground the ruling. So I wouldn't be surprised if it takes them some time. If this is one we see come out later in the term, you know, maybe later in the summer. But again, I don't think I'm great at predicting that.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Are there cases in which there is some advantage for patent holders to look for payments at multiple points in the supply chain?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's a lot of the briefing, some of the amicus briefs, and then some of the argument. I didn't get that much into it, but some of the argument really turned on that. And there's, you know, so one of the examples that counsel for Lexmark gave in the argument comes from a brief from the law professors or and economics professors who say, you know, think about a microchip that has multiple uses. So maybe it can run a cheap digital camera, you know, like a, you know, a fairly cheap little digital camera, but it can also run some really high-end video processing features in a very expensive set of equipment, right? So those chips would have very different values to the users. And if you make the seller of the chip charge just one price, then we would expect them to kind of look at the market, see what's the most profit maximizing, and pick some price that's somewhere in the middle, maybe on the higher end, maybe lower depending on volume, but would likely make the price high enough that certain uses of the chip just wouldn't happen, like the chip being sold in you know, cheap digital cameras, like the kind I used to, you know, you buy maybe for little kids getting their first camera. So some of those uses would just go away, and the brief by the economists argues this would be bad, that instead, if you could say, all right, we're going to sell these chips, but we're only giving you a right to incorporate them into the next product, and then depending on what that product is, those people who, before they sell the product, are going to have to come back to us and get the license to sell and use. At that point, we can charge a much lower fee to the cheap digital camera producer and a much higher fee to the producer of the high-end video equipment. So it's a little more complicated and burdensome, but it would allow both of those types of goods to be produced, whereas if you just have to charge one price initially, then you're not going to get the multiple uses. Now, sometimes you could just have the manufacturer that sells directly to the builder of the cheap digital camera and to someone else, but with the long supply chain where maybe the chip is incorporated into a circuit board and that circuit board is then incorporated into something, and that component as a whole then can either go to the cheap camera or the expensive equipment, at that point it becomes much harder for the original chip manufacturer to, just by charging that initial price, discriminate between the person making the cheap good or the more expensive good. So what this means is some sales just won't happen that would happen if you gave the producer, the patent owner, more control. The argument on the other side and the argument that First Impression made was, hey, this could be terrible because you're going to have all sorts of goods sold into the global supply chain with all sorts of restrictions on them. It's going to be hard to keep track of it. Consumers or downstream purchasers who combine these components with other components are going to be surprised, and they might be kind of held up like highway robbery. But the response to that, and the response in the law professor's brief was, you know, it's generally much more efficient to do one unrestricted sale. So in those situations where you have a good that has one use and it's going to be bought by the same kind of, you know, in the global supply chain, the same kind of equipment manufacturer, you would much rather just sell it at your set price and be done with it, because any of the downstream relicensing or monitoring, of course, imposes cost on the manufacturer. The manufacturer's not interested in that. So you really should expect the kind of downstream restrictions only where they make sense to the manufacturer. And here in Lexmark's case, Lexmark thought it made sense because effectively it allowed them to sell cheaper cartridges to some consumers. And by selling other cartridges without restrictions, they gave that option to, okay, here's our price if we don't get to restrict the reuse. And so if patent exhaustion is held to be in effect here, then we could expect that the cheaper cartridges go away. There'll be a higher initial price, maybe even higher still, since the we know those cartridges could be reused and refilled, so the initial price of cartridges may go up more, although competition from other printers may push those prices down. It's hard to say. But that's kind of as Justice, I can't remember if it was Justice Sotomayor or Justice Breyer, one of the justices said, look, both sides are talking about the global supply chain and how things work and reliance interests, and it seems that there are risks on both sides to either a strong patent exhaustion rule or you know, you're free to limit through contract the patent rights that are passed on, and therefore lots of downstream restrictions mean possible rule. That either way, there's possibility of disruption and of less efficient economic activity. So the justices seem concerned and seem to see issues on both sides.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Professor Olson, would you like to make any closing remarks?
Well, thanks for having me. It was interesting to talk about the case, and I'll definitely be looking forward to its resolution. I think the justices are completely right, and the amicus. We had lots of amicus action in this case. This potentially has a very significant effect on commerce and on international as well as domestic manufacturing and sale. And so we can really expect that it's going to affect the way manufacturing happens, the way sourcing components happens. And we may either see kind of a bloom in innovation in licensing, which gives some rights but not others, and we'd kind of see over time whether that is more efficient and works out. Or we'll see a strong, we could see a strong patent exhaustion ruling, in which case, you know, we're going to see, I would expect some creativity by manufacturers as they still try to segment the market and figure out other ways, whether they be technological means like chips that make the printer only function with, you know, if it's been authorized, and then on the other hand, the competitors try to figure out the code to those chips and put software in to fool the chips so they do work even after they've been refilled. And then we have copyright lawsuits, and then we have fair use arguments about programming around that code. So this isn't going to end on either side with this case, but it is going to affect very much and very directly the way the parties approach these issues. And since the economic interests are strong enough, no matter the way this comes out, we will continue to see people who want to refill cartridges and reuse and remake patented goods trying to do that. We'll continue to see people who want to import from a country where the good is sold at a lower place to a country that sells at a higher place. And we'll continue to see patent owners and manufacturers who have great economic interest at stake trying to restrict those kinds of activities. So it's not going to be the last word on that sort of thing, but it's definitely going to have an effect on how all of that goes on. So I think it's definitely a case to watch, and I think the effects on the economy and international commerce are likely to be significant.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.